Time here on RNIB Connect Radio to chat with actor Laurie Davidson, who is playing Jack, the title role in Richard Bean's new comedy Jack Absolute Flies Again at the National Theatre, which will be audio described on Friday the 5th of August at 7:30pm with a touch tour at 6pm, and on Saturday the 20th of August at 2pm with a touch tour at 12:30pm. Hello Laurie, and welcome to RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello Toby, thank you for having me.
As we're recording this interview, you are currently in previews with the press night of Jack Absolute Flies Again tomorrow too. And I wondered how the previews have been going so far and whether you would be able to give me a bit of background to Jack Absolute Flies Again, as I believe it's based on Sheridan's The Rivals.
Yeah, that's right. It's a reimagining of Sheridan's The Rivals. Ollie Chris and Richard Bean decided that they wanted to redo the play and set it. Originally, Rich had the idea that he wanted to set it during the Boer War, and Ollie thought, well, no, that doesn't make sense. Let's do it during the Battle of Britain, because the problem with The Rivals inherently is that you, for a modern audience, is that it's all about land and marrying to acquire more wealth. And I think it's harder for a modern audience necessarily to fall in love with these characters. And what's so great about what Ollie and Richard have done is they've set it during the Battle of Britain, where these characters are so pressured to find love, and in the case of Jack and Roy and Julia and Lydia, to have sex for the first time. You know, these are young people who might die tomorrow, and so it's a pressure cooker to try and everything's accelerated to try and tell the one that you love them, because quite literally you're going up in a fragile little aircraft at any moment and you might not come back.
I give you 16 minutes to consider Miss Lydia Languish.
Lydia?
16 minutes, and if at the end of it you agree without any condition...
But Father...
Be quiet, I'm shouting! If after 16 minutes you agree to do everything on earth that I choose, I may forgive you. If not, hell's bells, man, don't enter the same hemisphere as me. Don't dare to breathe the same air or use the same light as me, but get yourself an atmosphere and a sun of your own. I'll disown you. I'll disembowel you. I'll unget you. I'll hunt down every last one of my sperm and rip them from your ungrateful body one by one. And damn me if I ever call you Jack again.
And Jack Absolute, obviously, he's a Second World War fighter pilot, and I wondered whether any of your family may have served in the Second World War and whether the character was based on any of their experience, or in your research, did you base the character of Jack on any sort of films of the times or recordings or diaries of Second World War fighter pilots?
Yeah, so three of my grandparents served in the Second World War. Grandpa was in Burma, fighting with the Indian Army. My grandfather was on a minesweeper, and my granny was at Bletchley. But no, none of them in the Air Force. But we were quite early on, because we were doing this about 2 years ago originally, before COVID happened, and Ollie Chris recommended a fantastic book called First Light by Jeffrey Wellham, which accounts his experience of training to be a fighter pilot, and just the process and the grueling process that you go through. And you don't start with a Hurricane or a Spitfire. You're on this tiny little de Havilland Tiger Moths, which are still very complicated aircrafts, but it just gives such detailed account of his first attempts up there, and working with the way I would describe it is like having your driving tests with someone in the cockpit next to you, and then you'd get marked on it, and then once you've completed that, you'd progress to the slightly bigger engined NA Harvard Mark II, I think they were, and that was a bigger aircraft, and that was a huge jump in power. If you imagine sort of, I don't know, like go-karters, young kids who are doing go-karting, and then they're suddenly put into an F2 car or something. It's a huge jump in power and maneuverability and how complicated these machines are. And then obviously after that, you either went into, if you were in the fighter program, you were in either a Spitfire or a Hurricane. Most of them were in Hurricanes, much more common to be in a Hurricane. And that again was an even greater leap behind size and power and maneuverability all sorts of things, and they were completely different. And as the war went on, you know, they were running out of pilots, and sometimes it's just staggering how quickly that process was often accelerated to get pilots across the line so that they could get them up in aircraft, because they were just short on pilots. And in our play, it touches on that. One of the new recruits comes in, and I think he hasn't even got in the cockpit of a Hurricane yet. The most he's flown is Harvard's, which is a step down, a practice aircraft, if you like. So yeah, just that was a brilliant book and source to use, and it gives great accounts of also of just the boys and the waiting on the airbase. If you imagine, it's sort of like being a fireman. You're sat there waiting for the bell to go off, and in your downtime, you know, playing cards and musing, and in our case, trying to find love, and in the pursuit of love, and then at any moment, the siren or the bell rings and you've got to scramble and run to your aircraft, grab anything you can and get up in the air to try and stop these bombing campaigns that were coming over. So yeah, that was a brilliant source of information for us.
Yeah, because I think it's tricky because I got nieces and nephews who are sort of in their late teens and early 20s, and I couldn't imagine them going through a similar experience. It, you know, I don't understand how people of that age actually cope during the Second World War, you know, going up. And as you say, your life expectancy could be very short. And yeah, it's interesting.
Well, it was 2 weeks, I think, was the average life expectancy of a pilot during the Battle of Britain. So yeah, not a long time. But I think you're right. It's hard to imagine teenagers or young 20-year-olds nowadays doing that. But I think human beings just adapt. We kind of take on whatever's thrown at us. It's hard to imagine, but I think it was just that was the time. And it was a great privilege as well to serve in the RAF. It was quite selective, and they had their own little quirks, and they were slightly rebellious compared to the other military forces. For example, they always undid a top button as a sort of middle finger to authority, just a sort of little in joke between everyone, and they were quite expressive with their comparatively more liberal with their haircuts, and they didn't salute, and it was a sort of more liberal affair. And I think that's partly because it was so dangerous and such a high skill factor.
I believe for an upcoming TV series, which is Masters of the Air, you actually got the opportunity to sit in the cockpit of a couple of Second World War fighter planes. What was that experience like?
Yes, yeah, so for Masters of the Air, it was American bomber pilots. Part of that, they were American bomber boys stationed in the UK, and they rebuilt, I mean, with huge cost. I mean, they've got Apple TV, they've got an incredible amount of money, which is brilliant because they'd rebuilt these cockpits completely identical to the originals. And what's staggering about them, and even that was a B-17 bomber, and so they would house about, I think there was 7 or 8 crew members, but there's just no space. I mean, you couldn't believe that they would house that many people in them, and just so many instruments. I mean, it would take you, that's what was I found so alarming about them. And looking at, I haven't sat in a Hurricane or a fighter, but I've seen pictures, and just there's so much going on. But yeah, it was just, you just feel the fragility of them, these things. I mean, that I know that the Hurricanes themselves, their whole tail was made out of steel frame with canvas, because it made it much more durable, so it could take bullets, could go through it, and it wouldn't really affect the structure of the aircraft. Whereas the Spitfire, which was more maneuverable and quicker, I think most of its fuselage was made out of steel or aluminium, I don't know, but it was certainly metal, and so it was much more vulnerable to hits. But these, you know, these tiny little aircraft, I mean, you think these pilots are just so vulnerable up there. That's what I find most intriguing.
And I think it's amazing if you get the opportunity to go to the Imperial War Museums in Duxford, or even the Imperial War Museum in London, and you can get quite close to these planes, and you do realise how tiny they were and how vulnerable the pilots were. It's incredible. As sort of, obviously, Jack Absolute Flies Again is a comedy, and I wondered, as an actor, how you approach a comedy. Is it just like approaching another play, or is there more to it? Because comedy is very much about the timing, and I suspect that's probably the same about most plays, but it seems to be more so in a comedy.
Yes, someone, a phrase that was tossed around a lot in rehearsals was, crying is easy, comedy's hard, or something like that. It's really difficult without an audience. So I think that's why our previews have been longer than normal, because you really don't know what you've got on your hands until you get it in front of an audience. It's very easy to, like you said, it's timing. You know, you have to punctuate. I was using this analogy the other day in rehearsals. It's like playing football, and Arsenal do this brilliantly. They pass around the box for ages, and then someone shoots. But you can't shoot on every line, because then you kind of never get anywhere. So in our play, it's quite difficult, because there are a lot of funny lines, and often you have to pass them on without really kind of giving them a punch or allowing the audience time to laugh, because it's not, you know that you're going to end up with the punchline or with the shot later on. So that's a skill you can only know, or that's something you only start to understand when you're in front of an audience. So in rehearsals it can be quite tricky, and the things that we found funny and audience collectively, you know, people have different, it just works differently. So it's been, they call it a third ear, which you have to have when you're doing comedy. You know, you're listening to your scene partner, but you've got to also have an ear on the audience, because you've just got to, it's just a different thing. Yeah, you've got to let them in and allow them ultimately to receive the jokes, and then come in with the next line on the sort of crest of the wave, so that it's not, you're not cutting it off before it peaks, and then you're also not letting the energy die. You know, you want to keep just the percussion of it going.
As I mentioned in my intro, there'll be two audio described performances of Jack Absolute Flies Again, and I remember going to see The Ferryman a couple of years ago, which you... and I'm not sure whether you made it for the Touch Tour, but I wondered how you thought your fellow actors and maybe theatre creators were aware of accessing the theatre for blind and partially sighted people.
So I've done a... I don't know if I did a Touch Tour on The Ferryman. I joined the second cast of that, so I don't know if we did a Touch Tour on that. I certainly did one during the play of The End of History, which is The Royal Court by Jack Thorne, and we did a Touch Tour then. And I think for this it will be brilliant, because especially the costumes and the there's so many brilliant props and costumes on this, and you know, the textures of things like the Sidcut, which is the flight suit that the pilots wore. It's a type of material that we don't really use now. So I think that's, you know, to be able to feel those things and get the textures and, yeah, things like that, I think it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, because I've had some great experiences on Touch Tours where you get that opportunity to go around the set, you know, sort of explore the set, to look at the props and handle some of the props, handle the costumes. And it's great to have the actors there, because having the actors there means you get an extra insight into how they form their character and everything else.
Yeah, well, you'll see, I wear, especially in this heat, I wear more layers than anyone else. I've got a leather jacket over the top of a Sidcut with a Mae West. I mean, the layers are extreme, but it's all worth it, because it looks great. But there's a lot of sweating on stage, and it's only going to get hotter. But the auditorium's nice and cool, actually. It's lovely and air-conditioned in the auditorium, but yes, I still manage to sweat a lot.
And I know you studied at Lambda, and access to theatre was very much part of the course that Lambda did, and I'm not sure whether they still do that now. But do you think that other theatre schools should be teaching their students more about accessing theatre?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that the National is doing a dementia-friendly performance here, and that's something very close to my own heart. My father has dementia, and those relaxed performances are great. I'm not aware of the access program at Lambda, actually. I don't know, do you know a bit more about that? I'm not aware of that program.
I know that they used to do training, and I suspect, you know, this is going back a few years and things may have changed since then, but as part of the course for both acting and, you know, sort of technical students at Lambda, they would have an access part of their course, and it would have, you know, people coming in to talk about both audio description and captioning and various other access performances and do some training and that kind of thing, so that everyone was aware that when it came to an audio description performance or a caption performance, that the actors would know what a touch tool was and that kind of thing.
Ah, maybe we did. Maybe we did, actually. Gosh, it's a long time ago. I vaguely remember doing a show up in the Lake District that had captions, because I thought, oh gosh, if I say my lines wrong, people will be able to cross-reference it with what's going up, and I haven't stuck to the script, so I better stick to the script. But yeah, I vaguely remember that there were captions, live captions going up, but it was a long time. It was, well, not that long ago, but my memory is awful. It was quite long ago.
I just think it's great that, you know, sort of more students, acting students and creative and technical students, whether, you know, if they're aware about it all, then it becomes second nature to them, and it's not something like, oh gosh, we've got to do an access performance, what do we do, what do we need to do for the describers and that kind of thing.
We did a relaxed performance at the Royal Court, and they lifted the house lights up slightly. And at first, it was quite shocking, because you're not used to seeing as much of the faces of people in the audience. So suddenly, I'm seeing way more of... But then after a while, I actually preferred it. And so when we went back to the show that we did regularly with that lighting state, I almost missed the being able to see the faces more. But yeah, it's a great thing. And I think that... The touch tours or touch, do you call them touch tours?
Yeah, touch tours.
They're brilliant, and I'm very happy that they're doing one for this, because I think it just, I can only imagine that it gives a real heightened layer of experience to anyone who's partially sighted.
Yeah, no, I can't recommend, you know, if people are going to the audio described performance, to definitely make it to the touch tour, because it really helps, you know, to get a better understanding of the play, because you have the intro notes which you listen to in advance, and then you get the touch tour, and then you get the live audio description, and it just helps to reinforce everything. Laurie, what would be next for you after Jack Absolute Flies Again? I know it's on until probably the autumn, but what's next for you? Perhaps a bit of Shakespeare?
I wouldn't say no. I don't know at the moment, actually. I've got a couple of projects coming out that have not aired yet on film and TV, but in terms of what's next, I don't know, which is an exciting place to be in. I'm quite looking forward to... Yeah, it's nice. I'll be auditioning now that once we do press night and get the show on its feet and we have our days free again, I can start auditioning again and looking at scripts and reading stuff. But it's quite difficult when you're all day, you only have Sunday off, and it's not really enough time to get your teeth into anything else, especially with a comedy like this. It's forever changing, you know, there's always tweaks going on up until the last minute, so yeah, which is great and how it should be. But it hasn't left much time, so that'll be next on the horizon when we open.
Well, I wish you all the best for the press night and obviously for the rest of the performances of the run of Jack Absolute Flies Again. And there will be, as I say, audio described performances on Friday the 5th of August at 7:30 p.m. with the touch tour at 6 p.m. and again on Saturday the 20th of August at 2 p.m. with the touch tour at 12:30 p.m. Well, thank you very much indeed, Laurie Davidson, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and telling me more about Jack Absolute Flies Again.
Thank you very much.